I next met with Dr. Matthew Kolke, and to help enter the sometimes complex world of neuroendocrine tumors, he presented a number of cases from his practice, beginning with a patient with classic carcinoid syndrome.
This was a 60-year-old man who had presented with a several-year history of progressive diarrhea and intermittent flushing episodes. After that presentation, his primary care physician finally thought of carcinoid and ordered a 24-hour urinary 5-HIA. It was found to be elevated at 90 milligrams per 24 hours, and normal is usually less than 6 milligrams per 24 hours. A CT scan then showed evidence of some mesenteric adenopathy and some scattered liver metastases involving both lobes of the liver. An octreotide scan was done, and that showed uptake in the mesenteric lymph nodes as well as in the liver, and a biopsy of one of the liver lesions showed a low-grade, well-differentiated neuroendocrine tumor. So the question here is, what would be the most appropriate next treatment for this patient?
So just to backtrack a little bit, can you talk a little bit more about the clinical symptomatology that he had over the several years, specifically what was really happening in terms of the flushing and diarrhea?
This is a pretty classic presentation for somebody who has carcinoid tumor and carcinoid syndrome. And the issue with these patients is that they're really tough to diagnose at an early stage. The primary tumors are very often in the small bowel. They're small. They're hard to see. You certainly oftentimes can't see them on a colonoscopy because they're in the small bowel. And even on a CT scan, it may not be as obvious as a primary colon cancer, for example. So they often go many years with these vague symptoms that are very, very hard to put together. And it's not at all uncommon that the first symptom is the one that's related to hormone hypersecretion, to serotonin hypersecretion, which causes diarrhea and we think also causes the intermittent flushing associated with carcinoid syndrome.
What did he actually describe in terms of the flushing?
The flushing is very characteristic. So it's not sort of the hot flash necessarily. It can be precipitated by stress. And the other real clue is the question I always ask is what happens if you have a glass of red wine? And that will often trigger a flush. And again, it's not turning red. It can be very sudden. It can be very severe. People turn beet red. And often their family or friends will notice and will question, say, you know, are you okay? It does not look like the normal kind of turning red from embarrassment.
And what's the red wine connection?
It's a trigger, something in red wine that seems to trigger the flushing. Other stressors or other triggers are often stress. So people will often say that they're complaining more of flushing during work when they have to give a presentation, for example, and not so much when they're relaxed.
Interesting. So now, did this man have endoscopy?
He did. And so he had had, with the diarrhea, he had a colonoscopy. It had been completely normal, as it so often is in these patients.
And what about upper endoscopy or capsule endoscopy?
So upper endoscopy is generally not as revealing. I don't think this guy had had an upper endoscopy. Capsule endoscopy is usually performed after they have a CT scan that shows that there might be something in the small bowel. I would say it's plus minus in terms of being helpful. Certainly surgeons, if it's going to be resected, will like to do it just to see where it is. But even that will only show the primary about half the time.
So what were the options that you were thinking about for this man at that point?
So this is a guy, and this is something that also comes up frequently. These symptoms come on over many years, and the patients will adapt to it, and they will think that it is fairly normal to have 5 or 10 bowel movements a day, and they adapt to the flushing, and people just think that they look red frequently. So it's not something, if you were to ask, is this really impeding your quality of life? Is this preventing you from doing things? Not necessarily. You'd probably be okay without treatment. The question is whether starting treatment at this point with those symptoms is in his best interest.
What was his thinking at that point? What was his state of mind?
Yeah, I think he probably would have gone with whatever the medical recommendation is here.
And what were the options that you were thinking about? Was observation a possibility?
Observation is a possibility. In this case, I'm not sure it would be the right thing. The option that I would really be thinking about here, he has carcinoid syndrome. There's not a whole lot of tumor bulk. What you'd be thinking about is starting a somatostatin analog. In this country, we'd be thinking about starting octreotide. And that's for a couple reasons. We know very well and have known for years that octreotide can shut down the hormone hypersecretion, decrease serotonin levels. So it can help from a symptomatic standpoint. It probably, by decreasing the serotonin, although there hasn't been any randomized data, but by doing that, we think it can probably prevent some of the longer-term complications like the carcinoid heart disease, for example, that can happen.
Now, in this man, did you do any kind of cardiac workup?
In this person, we did not, although some people would argue that doing a baseline echocardiogram in these patients is not such a bad idea.
And the cardiac issues with carcinoid, is that primarily valvular?
It is primarily valvular. So generally, the patients who have longstanding carcinoid syndrome, they will develop fibrosis and retraction of the valves on the right side of the heart because of the serotonin exposure. So over the long term, that can lead to right-sided heart failure, and occasionally in severe cases, we'll even think about valve replacement.
So again, octreotide was a possibility. Any comments on radio-labeled octreotide? I know it's not available in this country, but what do we know about this?
It's a great idea. There have now been thousands of patients in Europe treated with radio-labeled octreotide. And the idea is, again, it's very simple. The tumors have somatostatin receptors. Octreotide is a somatostatin analog. And by attaching a radioisotope to the somatostatin analog, you can effectively deliver localized radiation therapy. And what we know from the very large series in Europe is that it can really work. So patients can feel better from a symptomatic standpoint, and in patients who have very octreotide avid disease, response rates of around 20 or 30% in terms of tumor regression have also been reported. What we don't know so well right now, because there really haven't been any large prospective trials, is we don't have a great sense of what some of the toxicities and especially what some of the longer-term side effects can be. There can be bone marrow suppression, thrombocytopenia. There have been a few cases even of myelodysplastic syndrome. So I want to be a little bit cautious before people just start willy-nilly getting treated with this.
Is there clear-cut evidence that it's better than octreotide alone?
I think it's a very different type of approach. Octreotide alone we use for symptoms, and based on the PROMID data, we know that it can improve time to tumor progression. The radio-labeled octreotide is a more aggressive therapy. I would put that more in the category of, you know, deciding between that or going with a chemotherapy or targeted therapy. So I don't really think about them in the same box.
So you don't see objective regression when you give octreotide, even though the PROMID data showed some suggestion of benefit?
Objective regression probably happens less than 5% of the time. It's really a cytostatic.
Could you talk a little bit about the design of the PROMID study and what was seen there?
The PROMID study was a randomized study. It involved patients who had unresectable small bowel carcinoid tumors. They were randomized to receive either octreotide using the long-acting formulation at a dose of 30 milligrams or placebo. And it showed that there was a clear benefit in terms of time to tumor progression on the order of 14 months versus 6 months favoring octreotide. So octreotide really did seem to slow tumor progression.
Any other somatostatin analogs that are being looked at, and what are the potential advantages over octreotide?
There is another somatostatin analog that is approved right now in Europe for carcinoid syndrome called lanreotide. It works very much the same way. It's a very similar drug. It's administered slightly differently. The octreotide LAR is administered using an IM injection in the gluteus muscle, which can be somewhat painful sometimes, although it works. The lanreotide can be self-administered as a deep subcutaneous injection. So the mode of administration is a little bit different. Efficacy is probably similar.
So what other options would be considered in addition to octreotide in a patient like this?
In a patient like this, I would expect that the octreotide would be very helpful in shutting down the serotonin secretion, making him feel better. And more than likely, if one were to follow this patient on octreotide and do a follow-up scan in 4 or 6 months, you probably wouldn't see tumor progression. I think this patient could do quite well on octreotide alone, perhaps even for several years. Very often, and very understandably, these patients say, I want the most aggressive thing done. With carcinoid especially, you want to be cautious. Sometimes doing everything up front isn't the best strategy. And using some of the targeted therapies right now, the data is not quite there to fully support that. So I'd be reluctant to think about everolimus or sunitinib. Surgical resection is something that should be thought about. And if one can remove the primary and if there are only a very limited number of liver metastases and you can remove all the disease, that's something that probably is helpful. This patient had scattered liver metastases involving both lobes of the liver. So doing a surgical resection right now, especially when you're likely to get benefit from octreotide, is probably not the right thing to do.
What about local therapy in the liver like RFA?
I think RFA can be very helpful in specific contexts. usually used as an adjunct to surgery. So the scenario that one might see RFA is you take out two large liver metastases and there might be a smaller one that's harder to get to, and you RFA that, and then effectively the patient is disease-free or in a minimal disease state. Probably less helpful for patients with more bulky liver disease. In those patients, we'd probably be thinking more about chemoembolization.
So what do we know in terms of the spectrum of drug activity with pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors as opposed to carcinoid? It seems like you can't just assume that if it's effective in one, it's going to be effective in the other.
We don't know the answer to that yet, and there are ongoing trials that are trying to address exactly that question. We know that octreotide can slow tumor progression in carcinoid. We're not as sure about that, interestingly, in pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. There's an ongoing trial right now called the Clarinet trial looking at lanreotide and looking at exactly that question in pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors, so hopefully we'll know the answer soon.
What about chemotherapy in carcinoid?
The traditional chemotherapy, when we think about chemotherapy, we think about streptozocin or temozolomide. For most carcinoids, not terribly effective. I think that's really been disappointing. Those agents are effective in pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors.
So in a patient who has progressive disease to the point of death, what are systemic therapies that you'll utilize in carcinoid other than octreotide, if any?
I think beyond octreotide, we're getting in carcinoid, almost getting very rapidly to a fairly data-free zone. But things that we talk about in someone with hepatic predominant disease, chemoembolization can be very effective in that setting. We also know that alpha interferon in some cases can be helpful in slow tumor progression. Everolimus, which we know is effective in pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors, was looked at in carcinoid tumors. The RADIANT-2 study suggested that there was activity there. A follow-up study, RADIANT-4, is now going to look more specifically at everolimus versus placebo in carcinoid to try to confirm the hints of activity that were seen in the first study.
I'm kind of curious how many new patients a year you see with carcinoid and pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors, and how many deaths occur in your practice from these diseases?
In our practice right now, we're seeing probably 150 to 200 new patients with neuroendocrine tumors every year. About two-thirds of those have carcinoid, and one-third of those have pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. We looked at our database in terms of the survival for patients with metastatic neuroendocrine tumors. Survival is pretty good, on average over 5 years. Keep in mind, it's probably a selected population, but these patients really can do well for several years and feel good for a long time.
So can you provide a current follow-up on this man?
This particular guy continues to do very well on octreotide. We've had him on octreotide for over a year, seen no significant tumor progression, working full-time, so is doing very well.
What about the diarrhea and flushing?
Those improved within a month of starting octreotide LAR.
But he still has it?
It improved. Our initial dose that we started on octreotide was the standard starting dose of 20 milligrams. In this patient, as in several others, it's probably a little bit low. He's done much better on the 30 milligrams every 4 weeks.
Do you see any toxicity or side effects from octreotide?
Very few. The patient sometimes will have a borderline elevated glucose level. It's fairly unusual that you have to institute treatment for that. You have to watch out sometimes for biliary sludging. If they still have a gallbladder in, there's a slightly higher risk of gallstones.
Have you had patients with a prior history of diabetes who you put on octreotide? And if so, what happens?
I have. If they already have borderline diabetes and they start octreotide, you do have to watch the blood glucose, and not uncommonly, you'll start an oral hypoglycemic. They'll do okay.
So how about your 42-year-old lady?
So this is a 42-year-old lady who initially had symptoms of epigastric discomfort about a year ago and was found at that time to have a pancreatic neuroendocrine tumor. The disease was localized. She had a Whipple resection, a pancreatic oduodenectomy, and was found to have a 4-centimeter, well-differentiated neuroendocrine tumor with positive lymph nodes. 3 out of the 8 lymph nodes were positive.
Now, did they go into the surgery, incidentally, knowing this is a neuroendocrine tumor?
They did. They had done a biopsy beforehand, although one could argue that you didn't even need to do that.
When you say, just in terms of the fact that the surgery would have been the same?
There's a pancreatic mass. I think some surgeons will say, go ahead and just operate.
What was the next step?
Well, one question, interesting, that comes up in these patients, they have node-positive disease, a fairly large tumor, is do you do any post-operative therapy? And right now, the answer is really clear. There is no evidence that adjuvant therapy following resection of a pancreatic neuroendocrine tumor or carcinoid tumor is of use. So the recommendation here is just to follow the patient with serial scans, usually every 6 months.
When you say there's no evidence, I'm going to assume there's no trial. Or has it been really looked at?
It has not yet been looked at. So there's no trial.
So she was followed off therapy, and then what?
And then about 12 months after the surgery, I was found to have evidence of several new liver metastases, as well as some new retroperitoneal adenopathy. This was biopsied, and it confirmed that indeed there had been a recurrence of what was a low-grade neuroendocrine tumor. So the question now is, what is the best therapy for this particular patient?
Now, how important is grade and the sort of pathologic workup in your decision at this point?
We right now are still fairly simple-minded about how we are classifying them, at least as it pertains to the treatment decisions. Very broadly, we are grouping them now into two main groups, well-differentiated tumors and poorly differentiated tumors. The well-differentiated neuroendocrine tumors are the ones where we think about the treatments like octreotide or everolimus or sunitinib. The poorly differentiated neuroendocrine carcinomas behave far more aggressively. And in those situations, we're thinking more like small cell regimens, platinum and etoposide.
And what fraction overall fall into low grade and high grade?
By far, the majority are the low grade tumors. The high grade tumors are not very common.
Do you see, I see that this lady had a liver biopsy that continued to show low-grade tumors. Do you generally see the same type grade as people progress, or sometimes is there a change?
In the vast majority of cases, the grade stays the same. There have been a few reports where people think it might transform to a higher grade, but that's not common.
So at this point that she was found to have metastatic disease, did she have any symptoms?
She did not have any symptoms at this point. She's continued to feel quite well.
So what were the options that you think are reasonable or that you considered at that point?
The options here, again, this is a patient who has fairly low volume disease, is feeling well, but clearly has shown some evidence of growth over the past year. And it's really the classic situation where one would think about using a targeted therapy. The two targeted therapies that have recently been approved for use in progressive advanced pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors are everolimus and sunitinib.
And can you talk a little bit about the data supporting those two agents and sort of how you weigh them out in a situation like this?
The data for both drugs come from randomized placebo-controlled trials. And in both cases, there was a very clear improvement in progression-free survival between patients who received the targeted agent or patients who received the placebo. And interestingly enough, the numbers were extremely close as well. Around 11 months progression-free for patients receiving drug, and then on the order of 5 months for patients who receive placebo. So both seem to have fairly similar efficacy. I think in deciding between the two, probably one of the biggest factors is just looking at the patient, looking at some of the comorbidities, and seeing which one might be a better fit for that specific patient.
So can you dissect that down a little bit in terms of the side effects and toxicities that you see and the comorbidities that you look for?
The side effects for both drugs have been well described. They're both used for other indications as well. For sunitinib, it's a tyrosine kinase inhibitor, has activity against the VEGF receptor. So one does see some of the classic side effects like hypertension, perhaps a slightly higher bleeding risk. And in rare cases, one can also see some hepatic toxicity. For everolimus, one can have some side effects like mild mucositis. One of the rare but potentially more concerning ones is some pulmonary toxicity and pulmonary infiltrate. So if there's underlying lung disease, one might not necessarily want to start with everolimus.
In your own experience and also from the data, what about quality of life, fatigue, those kinds of issues?
Quality of life seems to be quite good with both drugs. One of the great things about having both of these available, at least in comparison to the more traditional chemotherapy, is how well tolerated they are.
Although, you know, sunitinib has kind of a little bit of a bad name, I would say, so to speak, coming out of renal in terms of quality of life.
It does. And the reason for that is that sunitinib initially had been used on a different dosing schedule. The dosing schedule that had been used in renal and initially was used for neuroendocrine was 50 milligrams a day for 4 weeks, followed by 2 weeks off. There was definitely some fatigue associated with that. In the neuroendocrine trial, the dosing schedule that was used was 37.5 milligrams continuously. it seemed to be much better tolerated without nearly as much fatigue.
What about objective responses with these two drugs?
We talked about the fairly impressive improvement in progression-free survival, more than doubling in both cases. But the flip side of that is that objective responses with either one are really pretty low. Response rate in the sunitinib trial was 9% and with everolimus was 4%. So realistically, you're probably not going to have a great rate of tumor shrinkage if you're using these drugs.
Oncologists are hearing a lot of discussion about everolimus nowadays because of breast cancer with the approval there. And as you mentioned, two of the issues are mucositis as well as less common pneumonitis. What's been your own clinical experience with those two specific issues?
The mucositis is not uncommon, but it rarely gets to the point where it prevents a patient from treating it. It is more like having small fever blisters. It's not the mucositis that you tend to see with a fluoropyrimidine, for example. The pneumonitis as well, it can happen, but the severe cases are fairly uncommon, probably less than 5%, resulting in treatment discontinuation.
Have you actually seen any cases of pneumonitis? What's the timing of it, incidentally?
I have seen it, and in the more severe cases, it occurred within a month or two. That was a situation where we did have to take the patient off. There are other situations where you're just incidentally seeing a few little infiltrates on the CT scan. The patient has no complaints. And in that situation, it's usually safe to just continue the drug.
You know, there are a lot of reasons for people to cough, particularly the flu nowadays. Is it difficult sometimes to dissect out what's going on with these people?
Because they're being followed with CT scans anyway, you're usually going to pick it up on the CT scan. Unless the case is very severe, you're not going to see it on an X-ray.
I was just flashing back to a breast cancer think tank we did last week, and there were all these discussions about corticosteroid mouthwashes and other local means to prevent or deal with the mucositis. Any of that crept into neuroendocrine tumors?
The majority, at least of my patients, seem to be doing quite well. We haven't had to resort to that.
So in terms of the comorbidities that might push you one way or the other, I guess certainly maybe somebody with a history of hypertension, you want to stay away from sunitinib, pulmonary disease, maybe you wouldn't be starting out with everolimus. This young woman had nothing, correct?
Or did she? This was a healthy young lady. That's exactly right.
So what did you do with her?
Well, in this particular case, we put her on one of our clinical studies. So one of the obvious ideas here is that if an mTOR inhibitor works and a VEGF pathway inhibitor works, what happens with both? This patient ended up going on a randomized study of everolimus with or without bevacizumab. That's being done by CLGV to try to answer that question.
That's your study.
It's my study, that's
and
right.
And how far into this is she, and what did she get randomized to?
Got randomized to the combination, did fairly well, is still doing fairly well. We don't have results from that study yet.
Interesting. Any Bev issues with her hypertension, proteinuria?
She's been doing okay, but that is something that we have had to watch out for with that combination. We have seen it.
And I know you've already looked at bevacizumab in pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. What's been seen that prompted this phase 3 study?
There was a phase 2 study that came out of MD Anderson that looked at the combination of everolimus with bevacizumab or everolimus alone and did see higher response rates and higher progression-free survival. That was a very small randomized phase 2. So it looks like a feasible combination, a promising combination.
What about Bev alone?
Bev alone has not formally been looked at in pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors.
Any particular reason to think that Bev or anti-angiogenic, other than the fact that sunitinib works, but in terms of, I don't know, VEGF levels, is it a bloodier tumor than average?
I think a very simple-minded way of looking at it is that, like renal cell carcinoma, neuroendocrine tumors are very vascular. So one might make the assumption that because they're so vascular, they may be more responsive to these single-agent VEGF-targeted therapies. That might be an oversimplification. I'm not sure we know exactly what the mechanism of action is in these tumors yet.
What's the accrual that you're looking for in this phase 3 study, and where are you with it?
It's a randomized phase 2. It already accrued 150 patients, so accrual is closed, and we hope to have results within the next year or so.
Now, if this lady had not been able to go on this study, what do you think you likely would have done?
I think I would have talked to her about the potential side effects and even involved her in the decision between these two drugs, because with regard to efficacy, it's a little tough to make an argument with one or the other.
What do you think? Do you think it would be basically a coin flip, or do you think, you know, if she had said to you, well, what would you do if it were you, what would your preference be?
Frankly, I have seen great results with both drugs.
And what about second-line treatment? Does a sequence make any difference?
Right now, we don't know if sequencing one before the other makes any difference. The good news is that these are fairly slow-growing tumors, and the vast majority of patients, I think, are going to get exposed to both drugs in one sequence or another. The bigger question is what happens after you've gone through some of these targeted therapies, and what happens if you have someone who has bulkier disease, who is much more symptomatic? The limitation of the targeted drugs, again, they're great with progression-free survival, but not so great with response. And for pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors, we do know that the alkylating agents, whether it's streptozocin or increasingly temozolomide-based therapy, can result in some very encouraging response rates. With temozolomide-based therapies, response rates have been reported as high as 70%. More realistically, it's probably in the 30 to 40% range, but these drugs really can shrink the tumors down.
Any other chemo agents? I thought I remembered something about capecitabine.
One very popular regimen right now is combining temozolomide with capecitabine. We don't know what the activity there is compared to temozolomide alone. There is an upcoming trial that will be initiated by ECOG. It will be a randomized phase 2 trial in which patients with advanced pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors will be randomized to receive either temozolomide alone or a combination of temozolomide and capecitabine.
I have a list of questions that have been submitted over the years or months from oncologists about this, and maybe I could throw a few out. One is, what about PET CT versus octreotide scanning for carcinoid?
Because most of the neuroendocrine tumors are low grade, they're really not very PET avid. There's some investigational PET techniques that are being looked at right now, but the standard FDG PET turns out not to be particularly useful for neuroendocrine tumors.
So here's a case that was sent in to us, 55-year-old woman complaining of right upper quadrant abdominal pain, a 15-pound weight loss over 5 months. CT scan reveals a mass in the pancreas and multiple liver lesions. CT-guided biopsy, one of the liver lesions, reveals a grade 3 neuroendocrine neoplasm. How would you treat this patient, and would you treat the patient differently if it was a grade 1 or 2?
So there are two aspects of this case that are particularly concerning. One is the very rapid onset of symptoms. The slower-growing neuroendocrine tumors, patients might have symptoms for years, and even after that feel fairly well. This patient is having weight loss over the course of about 5 months, so that suggests an aggressive course. And the aggressive nature of this tumor was confirmed on the biopsy, which showed a grade 3. That's a high-grade, poorly differentiated neuroendocrine carcinoma. So this is a situation where one might think about platinum etoposide as a first-line treatment.
And what about grade 1 or 2?
Grade 1 or 2, I would expect the clinical course to be a little bit more prolonged. So you might see the weight loss, but instead of over 5 months, you'd probably be seeing it over a year or two. If this were a grade 1 or 2, though, she's having pain, she's having symptoms, she probably has fairly high tumor bulk. So this might be the type of patient where instead of going first to a targeted therapy, I go to a chemotherapy, whether it's streptozocin or temozolomide, to try to decrease the tumor bulk.
What's the reproducibility of grade? You know, it's been much debated in other tumors. And where does Ki-67 fit in?
This is one of the things that I think the field really needs to work on, because the reproducibility is not 100%, and the cutoffs have been changing over time. We are running into some situations, specifically with Ki-67, where the tumor looks well-differentiated, the patient is acting like a low-grade, but the Ki-67 is read out as over the cutoff, over the 20% cutoff, and the pathologist will call it a high-grade tumor. So I would just throw out a warning flag to oncologists to really look at the pathology report, look at the patient. Those sorts of patients where it's only the Ki-67 a little above the cutoff probably should not be treated with platinum analogs. We probably do want to look at more of the targeted therapies. So I think it's something where over the next year or so, a lot of the investigators will be looking at, are these the right cutoffs to try to make it more consistent with the treatments the patient should receive. One of the questions that does come up is, we have a lot of these options. What's the best sequence of therapy? And it remains something that is not sorted out. It may be not as big of an issue as we think, because fortunately, again, most of these patients will be exposed to multiple therapies over the course of their disease. So I think the thing is just to make sure you have a long-term plan. You don't have to give everything right up front.
You mentioned your trial of everolimus and bevacizumab. What about everolimus and sunitinib?
Everolimus and sunitinib, as well as other tyrosine kinase inhibitors, has turned out to be difficult to give. There are synergistic toxicities for whatever reason. So that particular combination is probably not going to be going too far, at least in neuroendocrine tumors.
What about other anti-angiogenics, for example, aflibercept, the VEGF trap, or ramucirumab, the monoclonal antibody to the VEGF receptor?
We would expect that both of those drugs would have potential activity in neuroendocrine tumors. I think trials are being planned with both.